Support for this episode of Judaism Unbound comes from the Ashman Family JCC in Palo Alto, California, whose vision is to be the architects of the Jewish future. The Ashman Family JCC is an incubator for new expressions of Jewish identity. It creates innovative Jewish learning, celebrations, and arts programs that inspire personal connections to people and ideas from across the Jewish world. Learn more at www.paloaltojcc.org. This is Judaism Unbound, episode 111, Unaffiliated Affiliation. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rothberg.
And we are here with the first interview of one of the members of the pilot cohort of Klal's Glean Incubator. That's a program that's trying to help a set of new organizations come to be that they call spiritual entrepreneurs or spiritual innovators. And our guest today is Debbie Bravo. She is the spiritual leader, teacher, educator, visionary, guide, innovator, writer, role model, and friend of an organization called Makom NY. Debbie Bravo has rabbinic ordination from the Hebrew Union College, and she was a rabbi of a variety of synagogues for about the first 15 years of her career in the rabbinate. And then about 3 years ago, she decided to take another direction in her rabbinate, founding Makom NY. Makom NY describes itself as having created the first model for a new kind of Jewish community in a suburban area, one that is reaching wandering and wondering Jews of all generations. Their mission is to initiate and innovate a new Jewish landscape that ignites this new Jewish community. Makom NY is targeted at the estimated 80% of Jews in the Long Island area who are not affiliated with any Jewish organizations on Long Island. The organization's mission is to ignite Jewish connection, purpose, and experience by creating a new kind of intergenerational community. They offer a meaningful worship, holiday celebrations, life cycle events, social action, and a variety of other activities, describing themselves as an intentional community where all people are personally welcomed and where social, denominational, faith, and financial barriers do not exist. Debbie Bravo has been a fellow of Klal's Rabbis Without Borders. We spoke to its founding director, Rebecca Serbiu, some time ago, and she was in the first cohort of the Glean Incubator run by Ilan Babchuk, who we spoke to last week. We're really interested in talking about what's possible in suburban communities because a lot of Jews live there, and it's not something that we've talked about too much yet. So let's jump into this. Debbie Bravo, welcome to Judaism Unbound. It's so great to have you.
Thanks so much for having me.
So can we start by understanding a little bit what Makom NY is all about? I mean, I guess I'd start by saying that you were for many years a congregational rabbi of a number of different synagogues that I think our listeners would kind of recognize as mainstream American synagogues. And now you're doing something else, which seems a little bit like a synagogue, but it's not. So it would be great if you could sort of explain what it is and what it isn't.
Sure. So for 17 years, I worked in mainstream Reform synagogues from Washington, D.C. to New Jersey to New York. And after 17 years, decided it was time to see what a new model of Jewish community might look like. I was curious, living on Long Island, where the demographics, though some will say are declining, are quite strong. There are more than 250,000 Jews living in Nassau County alone. And I thought, how can we figure out how to engage the 80% of Jews on Long Island who are not so interested in typical synagogue life, but are interested in connecting Jewishly, are interested in Jewish culture, in learning, both for children and for adults alike, and how might we do that in a different way than the way programs run in synagogues?
You know, why is it that a synagogue can't do the things that you're talking about or doesn't do the things you're talking about, and a new organization had to be created?
So I actually believe that many synagogues could do much of what we do if they chose to. Also, the types of program that we offer are sometimes very, quote, synagogue-y, meaning they might look like what you find in a typical creative, innovative synagogue. But some of the programs are meant to reach people who never were connected to a synagogue, whether it's meditation and mindfulness, or it's a huge mitzvah project in the middle of Yom Kippur that involves food, which typically would be forbidden on Yom Kippur, but to try and teach what fasting on the holiest of holy days could really mean for individuals and families. It might mean on 9/11 taking a hike into a park and having a meditation and prayer opportunity in the middle of that hike, as opposed to coming together for a typical 9/11 memorial. It might mean that our High Holy Day experience looks a little bit different on the evening of Rosh Hashanah, on Erev Rosh Hashanah, instead of opening our service with very few people attending that first service, which is pretty common these days, especially on Long Island where we are. Instead, we have a potluck Erev Rosh Hashanah dinner where people who wouldn't otherwise have family and community are able to come together in prayer and song and for great food and really for community as we embark on the beginning of the High Holy Day experience. So we function in a different way. We still have a group of lay people whom we call an advisory council who give us guidance, but this is a staff-driven, rabbi-driven community. And the role of the lay people is to support. It's not to dictate what happens. So those of us who run the programming, we're really in charge of the programs. And we solicit input all the time from the lay people, but it's a very different kind of a relationship than what most synagogues experience. Lots of people call us Chabad-like, but the liberal version of Chabad. But I believe that much of what we do programmatically, much of what we do to appeal to our families and our school program could be replicated in synagogues if they were really willing to embrace innovation. I think innovation is often hard when you've been doing something the same way for a really long time.
Talk to us. We've had a few different guests who have mentioned Chabad and becoming a new kind of Chabad outside of the realm of Orthodoxy or Hasidism, where Chabad sort of dwells. And you're talking about being a liberal Chabad. What, when you're getting at that, what are the particular elements of Chabad that you are trying to channel in what you do, but in a very different kind of religious, theological sense?
Chabad is great at marketing, great at outreach, great at the interpersonal, great at making people feel welcome and truly being welcome into the community. And their focus is on community. It's not on creating a synagogue, building a big building. If you look at most of the Chabads, not all of them, but most of them, their buildings are small, often homes, and it really revolves around building a relationship with the rabbi of that community. So for us, the areas where we are similar to Chabad is that it's a lot about creating community and building relationships. We say that we're building our community one Shabbat dinner at a time, as different people come together around the Shabbat table in my home. We have beautiful conversations about where people have been, what they're looking for in Judaism, in life, with their family, what are the challenges that they're facing. And then we hear their stories and we learn more about how to help them to move forward on this journey. So in those ways, I think Chabad, we're very similar to Chabad. I think Chabad is also doesn't charge a large fee to walk in a door. Synagogues often, not always, but often to walk in the door, you have to pay thousands of dollars toward a membership model. And that's in order to keep up those very large buildings that were built when the synagogues were established. So it's completely understandable, but it isn't necessarily appealing to many people, especially the new generations of Jews who are coming up. At the end of the day, Chabad is an Orthodox model. And often people forget that, until they're at a moment in their Jewish life where it hits them and they realize that they're actually not Orthodox, and that is the only connection they have.
I'm really interested because we've spoken with a variety of different folks over the course of the podcast from the Reform movement. And so I'd love to hear, I have sort of two questions that I think are related, but I'd love, I'm itching to hear where you'll go with them. First is, so you're a product of the Reform movement in certain senses. I mean, even on your website, it talks about you went to a Reform Jewish summer camp. But so how has Reform influenced the creation of Macomb and your rabbinic life? And the other question I'd ask that's maybe delicate, maybe not, is do you think of Macomb as a Reform space? Is it a reform community or is it something else?
Two very good questions, not delicate at all. I am absolutely a product of the reform movement, born and bred, embraced by, supported by, educated by the reform movement. And there's no question that I am who I am today because of the reform movement. I grew up in the suburbs of Chicago. I attended the very well-known Olensing Ruby Union Institute camp in Oconomowoc, Wisconsin, that is known to produce many, many rabbis and cantors and Jewish educators and wonderful lay leaders across the board. I was involved with my reform group in Hillel when I attended college at Washington University in St. Louis, very much a product of the movement. And I've also given back to the movement in many ways. I've served on multiple different committees for the CCAR, which is the Central Conference of American Rabbis, our rabbinic umbrella organization. So it's been a huge part of my rabbinate. But as I made this very intentional, thoughtful decision to do something different, and as the conversation about new models for Jewish community was quickly unfolding right at the moment that we were launching Makom NY, it seemed obvious to me that though my reform background and upbringing absolutely weighs into who I am, it's not necessarily the direction I wanted to go with a new kind of community. People aren't as attached to denominations as they once were. And though I 100% embrace and support many of the programs within the reform movement, I also embrace programs within the conservative movement and programs that are non-denominational or pluralist by nature. And so the answer to your second question is our community is very intentionally a pluralist community. We say that there are people who come from reform backgrounds, conservative backgrounds, reconstructionist backgrounds, traditional backgrounds, liberal backgrounds, secular backgrounds, and no backgrounds. And we welcome everybody. But our goal is to create a community that isn't about are you reform or are you conservative? Because in today's world, I actually think that the two have blended together in many different ways. Maybe not when you look at the clergy as much, at the participants and members of denominational synagogues, it's hard to tell the difference between one and the other in many communities.
I guess the way that I've been trying to think about some of this stuff lately, especially as it pertains to synagogues or to the functions that we've traditionally imagined that synagogues play, is that if we looked around, if we didn't have any synagogues, if there just were no synagogues in America, and we said, who are the American Jews today? What do they need? What do they care about? And what institutions would we build in order to meet the needs that they have and the aspirations that they have and the potential that they might have to connect with Jewish things that they don't know about? What are the institutions that we would build? And I think it's pretty clear, to me at least, that we would not build the set of institutions that we have currently. And the question, the sort of strategic question is, what do you do in that situation? How do you bridge the way that the institutions should look if we were building for today and the way that they do look because they're the holdovers from having perhaps been built for the right way for a previous time? And I'm thinking just in terms of what you're talking about in terms of the shared space with other religious groups, right? It seems like, 50 years ago or 70 years ago or whenever it may have been, there was some really deep psychological need of Jews to say, we have our own spaces, right? We can afford it. We've made it, right? We want to feel like we're established here in America. We want to feel proud of the Jewish building, just as the Christians feel proud of the Christian building. And they were able to afford to build a building that was mostly empty. That was mostly, on Shabbat, maybe it was full, maybe not. And on the high holidays, it was super full. And the rest of the time, it was mostly empty. But it was both financially possible and psychologically okay. And now, it seems like, right, I think a lot of younger Jews, like, they don't care that there's a freestanding Jewish building. That doesn't feel like something that fills them with pride. They're very happy to use a building that's used for other purposes, And so even that need alone, which was a totally understandable psychological need in the 50s, is simply not present in the 2010s, you know, right? And then to say that, what sense does it make then that the Jewish community is full of these buildings that are mostly empty?
I've had different experiences with these synagogues that are closing, and maybe this will shed some light on the kind of question and thought that you're sharing. I've had the experience with a wonderful synagogue in Livingston, New Jersey, Temple Emmanuel. I used to live not far from there and knew their community quite well. And when they, for a variety of reasons, were closing their doors, one of their past presidents so kindly embraced me and said, "We want to give you whatever we can because we love the concept of what you're doing and we want Judaism to continue and we don't want to see congregations closing. We want to see Jews thriving." And so this past president of that synagogue, you know, said, "Come out here. I want you to come and take stuff. You know, we open the doors to the whole Jewish community, but we want to give you stuff first because you're starting something new and you need this stuff more than these other synagogues in our neighborhood." And they donated to us everything from hundreds of prayer books and library books to beautiful brass Shabbat candlesticks that we use every week, to these beautiful stained glass windows that their children made in their Hebrew school, to Hebrew school books, just all sorts of different things, to just basic administrative supplies. And what a beautiful sentiment that was, because their concept was they were merging with another synagogue. They, I think, knew that many of their members would go with them and many wouldn't. But for this past president, who had committed so much of his life to this synagogue, he cared more about Jewish community and the future of Judaism than he did about any one particular Jewish organization. And I think that's beautiful, and I also think it's unusual, because my experience with most of the other synagogues as they are closing, and I can only speak to Long Island, but Long Island is watching synagogues close every single year. Multiple synagogues are closing their doors because they can no longer stay alive, mainly for financial reasons, often because the building has become such a burden, and often because the demographics in that particular neighborhood have changed. And most of the time, I barely can get a phone call back or have a conversation with the folks in these synagogues, because they're either just so sad or angry or hurt by the fact that their synagogue is closing that they can't see to the tomorrow of the idea that, okay, one door closes, but another door opens.
I'm a child of the 90s, and so me and everybody from that demographic listening, I'm thinking about the song Closing Time by Semisonic, which is, you know, a great little anthem. And people, so one of the famous lines that's so relevant to this conversation is, every new beginning comes from some other beginning's end. And so that's a great line. But also the song itself is, I mean, I know this because I've read interviews with the writer of it. It's about two things. It's called Closing Time. It's about the closing of a bar. It's about, you know, people having their last drink before they go home, et cetera, et cetera. But it's also brilliantly, the lyrics also work. So it's about the birth of a child. It's like really incredible, and part of why I think it's stood up so well over 20 years since it came out. But what you see from that song is that, in a literal sense, the closing of this, the closing of this bar, they're not talking about closing its doors forever. They're talking about, you know, just closing at the end of the night. But it's being used as an allegory and having another purpose as the birth of a new being in the world. And so I just am loving and appreciating what you're bringing to light about what the closing of a congregation can mean, because we think of it as like a cliche, like, oh, sure, you know, every new beginning comes from some other beginning's end. But I think legitimately, like in a literal sense, those candlesticks and those prayer books that you got from that congregation helped you establish your, like, that's a literal new beginning coming from somebody else's literal end. And we know that that's how life works. Dan, I'm not, Dan is the one who deserves credit for this idea. You know, we understand that human beings are not meant to last an eternity. Most of us, we've seen movies or read books like Tuck Everlasting that problematize the idea of living forever. Like, it would not be good if we could live forever. But with institutions, we haven't been able to think about that. So I like, this is a pseudo question and mostly me rambling, but like, I really appreciate you bringing that. And just, I'd love to hear if there's any other stories you have of how something in Jewish life coming to a close has, for you individually or for your community, meant the rise of something new and powerful.
I think there's been a lot of opportunity that mostly has not come to fruition, meaning my colleagues and the other synagogues in the area, not all, but many, they're struggling to stay alive, many of them. And so for someone who is struggling to stay alive, it's very challenging to imagine perhaps being able to help someone be born. That's a challenging thing, I think, for a lot of people. And so it presents itself in many different guises, but ultimately, I think for most people, that's hard. And I was just visiting with someone recently in hospice. And when people are in hospice, they know that there are things they need to do to be able to say goodbyes and to put closure on their lives. Because by the time you get to hospice, often that's where you are mentally. But I don't think we're so good with organizations. And I'm not sure that some of our organizations have the capacity to do the incredible amount of change that would need to happen to make it look as different as it needs to look and feel to attract the next generation, or to make it look financially viable, or to create a new membership model that's going to be appealing. And there are many synagogues who are trying, but the ones that are really bold, those are the ones that are going to survive. I know that a colleague of mine from Cincinnati is one of the interviews that you're doing, and she was really bold when she said, "We got to sell this building. The building is pulling us down." And meanwhile, they're surviving while many of the communities around them are really struggling financially because they were brave and courageous and creative and willing to push themselves to say, okay, what matters most? Does it matter that we have this really nice building, or does it matter that we can be together as a community living Jewishly and supporting one another in the various cycles of life?
Part of me wants to say to folks that are running synagogues, you know, be bolder. And part of me wants to say, you know what, I think actually what we're talking about is so different from what your organization has been about for so long that it might actually be the best thing to say, could we invent a wonderful Jewish rituals for grieving and for closing down certain ways of being Jewish? And by the way, we have precedent for this. You know, we have all kinds of precedents, you know, of remembering lost Jewish institutions or lost Jewish practices of one kind or another, including, you know, I've been talking about the idea of that we study the sacrifices, right, which we haven't done for thousands of years, and many of us think hopefully we'll never do again, and yet it's to study them is still a major part of Judaism. And it was interesting to connect that to what you were offering in a way to these synagogues, is to say, you know, could we somehow capture your story, and could we integrate your story into our story so that our community will study your story and understand ourselves to be a child of yours, you know, a descendant of yours, as opposed to what's going to happen otherwise, which is that you're going to close down and your story will be forgotten. And this actually connects to what I wanted to ask you, which is sort of about the role of the rabbi in this next iteration, because I also think that one of the roles of rabbis, which I feel like they're not really playing for in our world today, is that, you know, rabbis have traditionally been really wonderful at helping people move through the process of death and mourning. And yet somehow rabbis have not been helping us do that institutionally. So we could talk about that, but I also wanted to talk about the role of a rabbi in a different way, in that you were talking earlier about the nature of what you're doing, that it's kind of about being very responsive to the spiritual needs as defined by the people. And then on the other hand, you said that we are a rabbi and professional-driven institution. And so I'm wondering, how do you connect those two, where you say, well, we're here to be responsive to the particular needs as defined by the people. We're not dictating to them what Judaism is or what they should need, which is, I think, what we often think Jewish institutions do. But then we're not here saying, now, you know, you guys come up with a solution. You know, we're here somehow saying, and yet I'm a rabbi and I'm here to offer you something. So what is it that you offer the people who are self-defining their spiritual needs?
When we created this model, it came from literally the first 18 people who were part of an initial parlor meeting in my living room. They were the ones who said, you're the rabbi. You know what's supposed to be in terms of Judaism, in terms of the community. We're not going to try and tell you anything other than that. We want you to make those kinds of decisions. But me making those decisions doesn't mean I make them without soliciting from so many people what it is that people are looking for. So a great example of that, we have a Moedon program. It's our version of Hebrew school. And in the matter of the 3 years that we've been in existence, we've grown from 22 kids at the beginning of our first year, and we held it in my basement, to this year where we are going to finish this third year with 150 students K to 7. And that's a huge leap and bigger than most of the synagogues schools out on Long Island. And I don't say that because we're actually not at all about the numbers, but I say it because we're trying to be very intentional in planning for growth while being able to maintain what is important to us as the community. I teach every single day. My educator teaches every day, and we don't want that model to change. I teach every bar and bat mitzvah student, and we have over 30 this year. We put it out to our community, and we said, help us think about what does growth look like so we can maintain who we are as a community, but we also want to be able to open the doors to people who see themselves finding a makom, a place in our community. So we invite people to conversations. We just recently, we sent an email to our fifth grade families soliciting guidance and advice from them about thoughts we have for sixth grade for next year and how we can create a new and different kind of a program for our sixth graders as they're preparing for B'nai Mitzvah. And so it's not about me standing at the top and saying this is what's going to happen in our community, but it is about me being the guiding voice of reason and of questioning, and then ultimately taking the information that we gather and figuring out what I think makes the most amount of sense for our community.
So when we speak with all sorts of different models of organizations, some of them that are locally based like you are have some visions for, you know, there will be 1,000 places like us around the country or around the world. And others of them say, you know what? We're doing our one thing in our local community, and it's not about expanding and, you know, taking over the world. But I'm curious, when you think about, you know, futurology for Macomb NY, for what you're trying to do, is your vision that this would catch on in other contexts near and far from Long Island? Or is this really about just building something really special just in your local area?
It's a great question. When we started having conversations about Macomb NY, we started, and the we was some lay people, parents, educators, people who came from a multitude of different backgrounds. We started having these conversations talking about what we were hoping to create on Long Island, and we were certainly specific to Long Island. But we also talked about the idea that we wanted to help others who were interested to create something in their own communities. And we acknowledged that each community had to be different because the demographics, the geography, the nature. I mean, Long Island is a place unto its own, and I can say that because I'm not from here. But every place is a place unto its own, whether you're in Chicago or California or the middle of the country. You know, each place has its own characteristics. And so every place would need to create a community in its own unique way. But we really wanted to be able to help other people. And I actually can say that I'm so pleased that people reach out to me all the time to ask how I did this personally. What did it mean to me professionally? What are the logistics around creating a new model of community? Literally every week I'm having conversations with colleagues, including one, yes, just this week, with colleagues across the country saying, tell us a little more about your model. How did you start? What does it look like? How do you create something that's financially viable? What are the resources out there to help you create this? And so it's not that I myself am looking to plant and create communities across the country, but I want to be a support to my colleagues who are looking to do similar kind of work in different places.
Can you talk a little bit about what you've found over the last 3 years in terms of what these folks are looking for? What are they seeking and what are they responding to that might surprise some of the leaders of the existing set of larger Jewish institutions and that you are able to fulfill? And I guess adjacent to that is the question of, you know, are you seeing that there's kind of room for a Macomb alternative, right? Meaning like there's certain kinds of needs that you don't really want to fulfill, but you've come to recognize that there's some really, really amazing needs out there that maybe even your organization is not set up to best fulfill.
So I'm going to answer that question in a couple of different ways. One is to talk about the two kind of general categories of people that we see coming to us. And this is Long Island. We're well-educated, sometimes financially very stable, and in other cases not as much, but I think often perceived to be. And culturally very connected Jewish community. And so we have two main groups who are finding their ways to us. One are families, and that's families with young children, families with school-age children, up until bar and bat mitzvah. And the other category is what I call the Jewish empty nester. So typically we understand empty nesters to be once your last kid goes off and you're alone in the home. I define the Jewish empty nester as once your last kid has become bar bat mitzvah and there's no longer this quote requirement of being involved in Jewish community. And those are kind of the two categories of people we see. What they're looking for is very different because of their stage of life, but kind of the quality and the way in which we program to them is not so different. So families are looking for ways for families to engage in meaningful Jewish life and also just meaningful life. Sometimes the Jewish piece is secondary, and how to flourish as a family, as human beings, as parents, as children in this crazy world in which we live. They're good with not having a huge sanctuary with yard site plaques on the walls and knowing that there's always going to be a four-piece choir and all of that in the service, because they're looking for a community where we know every child's name and every parent's name, where the kids run up on the bima every Shabbat. There are always children at our services. We don't have to do anything to convince them to come out. And they feel so confident in the process of becoming bar and bat mitzvah that bar and bat mitzvah is no longer an end to the process, but just a beginning for what they're going to do next. And so that appeals to a lot of families in our community, and that's what they're looking for. The kind of Jewish empty nester, they're looking for community. Some of them are looking to be educated Jewishly in a way that they never could take the time to do when they were raising their own children. Some of them are looking to create rituals. How that is defined programmatically, I would say, is there's two main categories. One is what I would call your traditional synagogue offerings, meaning Torah study and Shabbat services and Rosh Chodesh programs for women, the beginning of every month, obviously holiday celebrations. But the other piece that is where maybe we're a little different is we offer a lot of cultural opportunities, cooking in people's homes, challah baking. We offer hikes and walks and meditation and things that maybe are a little different to a typical synagogue's offerings. That's the part that we're still struggling with. We are still working to figure out what are the right programs to offer to people for whom Torah study and services are not what appeals to them. And we're also struggling with how to find those people. I also want to say that we don't want to do everything that Jews want. There are lots of things in our community that are done very, very well. And we don't need to duplicate that. And the thing I talk about all the time, it's a great example, is the Purim Carnival. I never, ever again need to run a Purim Carnival. There are great Purim Carnivals in our community. And every year we put out to our community, please go to this Purim Carnival or this one. You might even see Rabbi Bravo there. Because why do we need to duplicate that? And they're doing a great job. We'll observe Purim in a different way. We'll observe Passover in a different way, any of the holidays, but we don't need to duplicate what's already being done.
I want to, before we close, just try and get sort of a window into what some of your programs look like, how they manifest. And so I'm wondering if you can just give us a snapshot of one or two moments of Macomb NY at its very best. One particular, whether it's a holiday observance or whether it's a community initiative or whatever it was, where what you created in that room, what you created in a holy sense, was really meaningful.
On Yom Kippur afternoon, there is a little bit of a lull in many communities in the middle of the afternoon. And we decided a couple of years ago, what would it look like to bring a mitzvah piece, to bring a way to help others on Yom Kippur, this really holy day, in the middle of the afternoon. So we investigated and thought about it as a fast day and what could we do? And we discovered an organization called Rise Against Hunger. And this organization helps you to create meals, which they send to places that are in need. And the meals are rice and nutrients and things like that. And they bring in, if you're able, they bring in all the supplies and you bag and put everything in together. And often there's this upbeat music that's happening, and the person who comes out from Rise Against Hunger is on a microphone and explaining where the food's going and how incredibly meaningful it is. And so for the last several years on Yom Kippur afternoon, we've had anywhere from 60 to 120 people bagging food to help those who would otherwise not have food. On the one hand, if you walked into the social hall on Yom Kippur afternoon, you would say, oh my gosh, this is everything but Yom Kippur. There's food on the tables. Yes, it's dry rice and nobody's thinking about eating it, but there's food out on a fast day. There's loud music playing. Yom Kippur is typically somber and quiet. On the other hand, it's this beautiful understanding and innovation of what Yom Kippur could mean to people. And we have families and individuals who come each year and look forward to this program now and tell us through emails and posting pictures that this was probably the most meaningful day they've had, and that it allowed them to really understand the importance of a fast day and why in Judaism we have fast days. So that's one example. And I'm going to stick to the High Holy Days for a moment, even though the High Holy Days feel very far away and also not really the focus of who we are. We focus on things all year round. But during our Yizkor service, when we're remembering people who have died, we don't have a permanent space, which means we don't have yard site plaques. We also did not want to create a Yizkor book like many synagogues do, because it's quite costly and most people just throw away those books at the end of the day. And so it's really not very green in terms of environment friendly. So instead, we solicit from people who are attending the services pictures, names, sentences, thoughts about a loved one, and we create a PowerPoint that is shared in the lobby on Yom Kippur Day, and once during a silent meditation in the middle of the Yizkor service, as well as in the half hour prior to the service. And it's an opportunity to not simply share a name, but to share a little about who that person was, what they meant to the loved ones who are remembering them. I thought of one other example, which is the way we teach Passover to our students. We took the idea of the Magid, of the telling of the Passover story, and we partnered it with the concept of perspective. And so what did we do? We taught our students to be able to retell the story so that every child, whatever age, could actually own that part of the Seder and tell the story. And we taught them the story, and it was told to them from multiple perspectives. God and the perspective of Pharaoh. So we knew that this was a successful experiment because one child at the end of the learning said to us, I don't understand why there would be 10 plagues put on the Egyptian people, because the Egyptians didn't really do anything to deserve such punishment. And it was in that moment that we understood that this child and most of the children saw the Passover story from a new perspective. And we know for a fact that these children are now the storytellers at their Passover Seders and are sharing a perspective that their parents and their grandparents never heard before.
So I wanted to ask you what the response has been to what you're doing from other rabbis, from other synagogues in the community, because I can imagine that there's concern, that there's often an attempt to say, it's not the forces of nature that are our problem, it's this, quote, competitor that is, you know, and if only this competitor wasn't here, we wouldn't be having these problems. And that's not good because it's ultimately ignoring the real problem, but it's also potentially very damaging to the, like we talked about earlier, to that baby that's trying to get born. So I'm curious what you found has been the reaction in the local community and beyond to what you're trying to do, because it really is a very substantial departure from what's been done before. And really, I think importantly, for what rabbis are sort of expected to do.
When we first started, the response from the community was slightly different than what we're experiencing today. My colleagues, especially in the synagogues in the neighborhood where I live and where we were working, were feeling very threatened by what we were looking to create. We worked very hard at the beginning to do everything as ethical as possible. So we did not reach out to anyone who belonged to another synagogue. People came to us and found us. If they still belong to a synagogue, we actually went above and beyond to say to them, please go back, have a conversation with your rabbi about what you're not liking in your synagogue. Talk to your educator, see if you can solve things. We worked really hard to send people away because our motto since day one has been, we're not about taking the 20% who are affiliated if they're happily affiliated. Our community has not grown at the expense of other communities shrinking. Our community is growing mainly by people who were not connected to Jewish community. And of course, there are a number of exceptions to that, but that is really the truth. Some of the organizations in the greater community have started to come around to alternate models and started to use different language. I think many of the established organizations like the JCCs and the federations, those kinds of organizational community places, they're still run and led by people who belong to synagogues. So I think once people see that this is a positive for Judaism and for Jewish community in the future, then we're going to see more support of communities like ours. I do believe that we will see a shift in the bigger organizations starting to be more supportive of communities like ours. I hope that's the case. I think once they realize that we are having success without taking away from the success of others, they will be more supportive. Many people tell us all the time that they're watching us. They're on our Facebook page. Our website gets more traffic than any typical synagogue website. And they're seeing how we're creating things and where our successes are and how we're creating a financially viable model and what the language is that we're using. And I think they're watching because they want to see if we can actually create something viable. And if so, then they're going to be ready to jump on board. And I can't blame people for not having the bravery and the courage to jump on board from day one. Luckily for me, those are my strengths. And so it's allowed me to do what I do. And luckily for me, I believe in what we're doing. And I think that this is what's going to help us to create Judaism for the future.
Well, thank you so much for coming on. This has been a great conversation. And I know that we're going to be referring back to this in the future. So just thank you so much, Debbie Bravo, for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And thanks, of course, also to all of you out there listening. We want to close out this episode, as we always do, by encouraging you to be in touch with us. And there are a few ways for you to do that. First, you can head to our Facebook page, Judaism Unbound, or our Twitter feed at Judaism Unbound. Second, you can head to our website, judaismunbound.com. And of course, you can hit us up via email at dan@judaismunbound.com or lex@judaismunbound.com. The last plug we like to make is that you can always send us a donation, either on a monthly recurring basis or just a one-time gift, and you can do either of those at judaismunbound.com/donate. So thanks so much for listening, and with that, this has been Judaism Unbound.